Liars. Nan knew she wasn't qualified to work at the magazine, but Professor Paulson, her advisor in the English department and the magazine's editor, had convinced her. It didn't take much. He said, "We need you." And, having rarely felt needed by anyone, Nan said yes. "There's a mountain of slush," he explained, as they walked across campus. It was autumn, halfway through the first semester of her junior year, but the leaves along College Walk were still fragrant and green. "Literally, Nan," he said, amused, his arms outstretched. "Boxes inside of boxes. Boxes blocking the back exit. I think it's actually become a fire hazard." She'd never heard the term slush before, at least not in reference to anything but melting snow. "Just go in and talk to Tammy," he said. "She's the office manager." He pointed down 116th Street toward the river, to the curved stone building where the magazine's offices were located in the ground floor. "I already called her about this, so she'll put you right to work," he said. "I'm lucky I thought of you." He smiled at her. "And so are you." He put his hand on her arm where her sleeve was rolled up. His skin felt cold and dry as chrome. Beneath them, the downtown train rumbled in its approach. He squeezed her arm quickly and, saying nothing else, disappeared underground. She didn't have to be told where the magazine's office was. Her university apartment was right around the corner. Every day on her way to school, she passed by the office door with its neat blue lacquered sign, verbiage. She'd always wondered what the office was like inside, much in the same way she had always wondered how it would feel to see her own name, her own work printed in the slick, glossy journal, always adorned with a painting or print in full color on the cover. Whenever a new issue came out, she went straight to the contributor's notes in the back, hoping to glean some kind of clue as to how all these people, mostly unknown to her, had found their way inside. It was, after all, one of the most highly regarded magazines in the slender realm of literary publishing, a fact strenuously asserted by her teacher when she'd taken a continuing ed fiction writing workshop the year before. At the first meeting of the class, her teacher, a wispy-haired novelist who wore snug-fitting jeans with scoop-neck ballet shirts tucked into them, laid out a variety of literary magazines in the center of the table. "These," she announced, "are the essential steps in your development and discovery. Where you publish and where your work appears will determine where next you'll go." The class passed them around, flipping through the pages with an air of indifference. Nan had never seen these journals before, and she hadn't been aware of their significance in the trajectory of a writer's career, but she admired how beautifully they were designed. The classic fonts and clean layouts, the paintings or sculptures or photographs featured in color portfolios inside. They seemed very serious, like books, and yet artistic and personal, and cared for, like diaries. Her teacher held up a copy of Verbiage. "I'm sure most of you know this magazine because of its association with this university," she said. "It's something to strive for, but, more likely, to dream about." She pressed the volume to her chest. "I was one of the lucky ones. They took the first story I sent them, and it changed my life." In high school, Nan's teachers had always praised her writing, and once she'd won a state-sponsored contest for a poem she'd written about being a lifelong resident of Vermont. "All I did was write about this place," Nan told her parents when she found out the news. She gestured to the kitchen's picture window with its view of the meadow, the thick pine forest along its edge, and the rolling green mountains beyond. "Well," said her mother, "that's all it took." "And that's all it should take," said her father. "You tell it like it is, your truth. That's what a writer does." Not that her parents knew exactly what a writer did. Her father made furniture and did carpentry. Her mother was a ceramicist and tutored kids on the side. But they had an artistic mindset and an appreciation for expression of all kinds, which they tried to pass on to their children. Nan had won the award as a senior in high school, and years later, the poem had yet to be taken down from its place on the refrigerator. In New York, however, her classmates' response to her work was less than enthusiastic. Of a story she wrote about watching a foal being born, and then die, at a farm near her house, an elderly woman in her class who wrote stories about her difficult life during the Depression commented, "When I read this, I felt like I was there, but there wasn't much beyond that." And of a story she wrote about her father getting attacked by a swarm of wasps while trying to free a sheep from a barbed wire fence, the surly male PhD dropout in her class whose impenetrable, deliberately confusing stories always referenced books Nan had never read and languages she didn't know, wrote, "Vivid Nan, but indeed uneventful." Some students were less constructive, no matter what the story was about. "I was bored by this," remarked the partner at a big law firm in Midtown, who always wrote mystery and crime stories that always included at least one drug-addicted stripper. "Nan," complained the morose middle-aged woman who wrote obsessively about the people she'd encountered during her stays at various rehab facilities. "Enough already with the Little House on the Prairie stuff." Nan would often go home after class, lie on her bed, and read through these comments, never knowing quite what to make of them. Even her teacher's feedback was confusing. A series of checks in the margin, a "nice" or a "hmm" at the end of a paragraph, sometimes a star, sometimes an X. Nan began to wonder if her teacher had read the stories while watching television, or while talking on the phone, or sometimes if she'd read them at all. One day after class, halfway through the semester, her teacher pulled Nan aside. They were on their way out, in the stairwell, Nan standing one stair below so that she was eye level with the outline of her teacher's bra. "I feel like you're holding something back," said her teacher, tentatively, as if expecting Nan to burst into tears or flames. "You're a good writer. I might even say talented. But I have a feeling you're withholding something, and I feel compelled to know what it is." "I'm not withholding anything," Nan said, which she felt was true. She was just writing about her life, writing what she knew, which is always the standard advice offered in this kind of endeavor. "Being honest with me," said the teacher, "will hopefully allow you to be honest with yourself. Writing is about being honest and articulating that honesty." It sounded like a riddle, and her teacher looked at her with the sanctimony of a wizard. "I am being honest," Nan said, eyeing the staircase. "There is a sadness inside of you," said her teacher, now placing her hand on Nan's shoulder. "I can see it. It's palpable. What has happened in your life to cause it?" A part of her teacher, and not a small part, was enjoying this. She had a hungry look in her eyes. But the worst of it was that she was right. Something had happened in Nan's life, which was the cause of her sadness, if that's what it could even be called. But why did she have to tell her teacher? Why was it necessary to tell anyone? "You're thinking," said her teacher, stepping down one step to join her. "You're processing something." Nan looked the woman in the face. She wasn't going to get out of there without saying something. So why make something up? "3 years ago," Nan said, as plainly as she could, "my brother died." Her teacher gasped and squeezed Nan's shoulder. "Oh no, how?" Only a writer would immediately ask how, thought Nan. "He was ice skating and fell through the ice," she said. She felt a wave of embarrassment as her teacher's face crumpled like a rag before her. "So, I guess I still think about him, and it's still kind of hard for me." The effect of her admission was disorienting. She felt lightheaded, as if pulling the words from deep within her had induced a kind of instant illness, like the bends. "Oh, Nan," cried her teacher, hugging her tightly. "Don't you see? We found it. This is what you should be writing about. I knew there had to be more, and there is. Your brother, your muse." "He's my brother," said Nan. Her mistake, the tense, sent a jolt of pain through her entire body. She wished she'd stayed strong, said nothing, or just lied. "We all need something like this to work from," said her teacher, "and this is yours. You must use it." She let go of Nan and wiped her eyes with the corner of her sleeve, smiling a kind of frown smile. She told Nan to take care, and that she'd see her at the next class, and then descended the staircase with a slow, satisfied majesty. Nan continued to write about her life in Vermont, but never once mentioned what had happened to her brother. This clearly frustrated her teacher, who, whenever her brother appeared in a story, put an aggressive series of exclamation points and question marks in the margin. Eventually, Nan received a B in the class, the first she'd ever gotten in her life. She didn't bother disputing it or going to see her teacher. She let it go, because her plan was to let the entire experience go. A plan that was only reinforced when, A few months after the class ended, she discovered a new story her teacher had published in one of the slick magazines she'd introduced to the class. The story was about a girl from New Hampshire whose sister had died while she was skating alone on a frozen river. In the wake of the event, the girl moved to Boston and lived a quiet, lonely existence of denial and emptiness, haunted by the memory of her sister, until she eventually threw herself into the Charles River and drowned. Nan stood at the magazine rack in the bookstore. She read the story twice through without stopping, her mouth growing dry and sour. What the hell? Was all she could think, and all she could say to herself as she walked back to her apartment, gathered everything she'd written for the class, and threw it all away. If she'd ever entertained any fantasies about becoming a writer, they were certainly gone now. If this was how it worked, if any person's personal tragedy was just grist for another writer's mill, clearly she wasn't cut out for it. This much she knew, and the revelation, it seemed, was the only worthwhile thing that had come out of the class. "Are you Nancy?" said Tammy, smiling in the magazine's office doorway. Her front teeth were tea brown. She was small, spindly, with green eyes and a leathery, friendly face. "Nan," said Nan. "Just Nan." "Not just Nan," said Tammy, stepping aside to let her in. "Professor Paulson thinks very highly of you. This is the first time we've had a junior in here as an intern. You must be a real star." The main room of the office was filled with stacks and piles of mail, canvas bags and plastic postal boxes overflowing with different sized envelopes lashed together with rubber bands. "Wow," said Nan. "It's completely out of control," said Tammy, her hands on her hips as if appraising a garden full of weeds. "That's why I'm glad you're here, and that Malcolm's finally back. Do you know Malcolm?" "I don't think so." "He was our intern last year," she said. "He graduated, literary studies, but now he's back, living in the city and trying to make a life for himself. He still comes in to read." "You sure you don't know him?" Nan shook her head. "He's kind of a character," she said, rolling her eyes. "An artist, he'll be the first one to tell you. But I'm grateful for him. We have no budget to hire anyone full-time, so without him, I'd probably be dead under an avalanche of this stuff." Nan looked at the envelopes. The variety of handwriting on them was dizzying. Cursive, print, type, scrawl, all going to the same place. Here, a musty, dimly lit room, practically a basement. "Intern, sit over there," said Tammy, pointing to an old-looking wooden desk at the far side of the room. "If you and Malcolm are both here at the same time, you'll have to share. Submissions can't leave the office. Is that clear?" Nan nodded. "Everything goes through me." Tammy pointed a bony thumb at her chest. "When the mail comes in, I log the submitter's name, the date they submitted, the genre, etc., into our database. So if, or I should say when, someone calls to complain and wants to know where their stuff is, I can look it up and tell them that we have it, it's here, but it's probably going to take a while." "Does that happen a lot?" asked Nan. "That people call to complain?" "What do you think?" said Tammy, gesturing to the wall of overflowing plastic boxes. "I've gotten to the point where I don't pick up the phone if I don't recognize the name or number on the caller ID." "Do they leave a message?" "Probably 40% of the time," she said, slapping her keyboard to wake up her computer. "Maybe 50. Nan began working at the magazine twice a week, in the afternoons, for about 3 or 4 hours a day. She wasn't being paid, so she had to squeeze in the time around her job at the language lab, where she worked behind the front desk, handing out tapes and videos and showing films in the viewing rooms. For the first couple of weeks, the only sign of Malcolm was his neat, font-like handwriting in the logbook, in which they recorded the decision made on every submission. In Malcolm's column, there was an unbroken chain of red R's beside each submitter's name, like a steady line of stitches down the page. The sheer number of submissions he seemed to get through was staggering. Tammy said that he could finish an entire box of mail in a single day. The longer Nan worked at the magazine, the more impossible this seemed. On good days, when she felt well-rested and well-caffeinated, Nan could get through a quarter of a box, maybe half, and she was reading poetry. How could Malcolm get through an entire box of mail when each fiction submission was at least 15 pages? Tammy's initial explanation of the protocol for reading submissions had been less than illuminating. "Read it," she said. "If you don't like it, or if you don't think it's up to snuff or whatever, throw in one of these. She held up a pre-printed rejection slip. "Thank you for allowing us to consider your work. Unfortunately, it does not suit our current needs." Seal it back up in their self-addressed stamped envelope, toss it in the empty bin, and away it goes. "Is there only one kind of slip?" "One kind," she said severely, holding up the slip again. "We don't have the kind of operation to vary our printed responses, or to respond personally to everything. Understand?" "Yes." "But here's the thing," said Tammy, softening a bit. "For the submissions that you think are good, but don't actually have a prayer, in this case, you can write on the rejection slip with a pen." She held up her pen. "Sorry," or "thanks," to give it more of a personal touch. Nan nodded, but she still looked confused. "In the language of rejection slips," said Tammy, growing tired of the conversation, "getting a handwritten note of any kind is the next best thing to actually getting your work accepted. It shows that someone actually read it, or probably read it." Even knowing the rules, Nan had no way to prepare for the effect reading so many submissions had on her conscience. Deep feelings of guilt and culpability and inadequacy for passing judgment over so many strangers, so many attempts at expression. And no amount of sorry or thanks ever made her feel better. Surrounded by the piles of rejected work at the end of the day, she sometimes felt like she worked in a kind of morgue. When she left the office at the end of the day, she usually had to walk around for a bit, along the top tier of Riverside Park, to shake off the people she'd unavoidably absorbed. The elderly woman from Florida who wrote simplistic rhyming poems about a neighbor's litter of kittens, or the rainbow she'd seen in Ireland. She'd signed her cover letter, "Please make an old lady's wish to be published come true." Or there was the Vietnam vet who wrote ranting, angry verse replete with graphic images of severed limbs and groins embedded with shrapnel. He'd enclosed a picture of himself, legless, in a wheelchair, holding a fishing pole in front of a trailer with a few scrubby palm trees in the background. After a month or so, Nan came into work to find a ruffled-looking young man with curly brown hair sitting at the intern's desk. "We were just talking about you," said Tammy, spinning around in her chair. "You two finally get to meet." The young man stood up. He was taller than she'd suspected and looked to be extremely thin inside his clothes. The leather belt that encircled his hipless waists looked like it might just as easily hold together her ponytail. He extended his hand and, through smudged, thick-rimmed glasses, looked her in the face. "I know you," he said.
"You do?"
"I recognize you," he said. "You're in the English department, right? That's your major?"
"Yes."
"These guys are saying you're doing well here," he said, glancing over at Tammy. "Are you trying to steal my job?"
"No, of course not."
"I'm kidding," he said. "I'm just kidding."
"Oh.
If you two want to flirt," said Tammy, putting on her dictaphone headset, "do it outside of the workplace. You've got mail to read." Before Nan could protest,
"Flirt?"
Malcolm turned to the wall of boxes and dislodged one from the tilting stack. "You can have the desk," he said. "I'll take this with me to the library."
"No, you won't,"
said Tammy, spinning back around in her chair. "Submissions stay here. They remain in office."
"But you've always let me take them out before,"
he said with a mild whine. "That was before I had a precedent to set," she said. "Now that there are two of you, I have to keep things consistent. Bring in another chair from the hall. There's enough room for both of you at the desk." Malcolm slouched out of the room. Tammy raised her eyebrows at Nan and smiled. "Oh, God," thought Nan, sitting down at the desk and scooting to the side to make room among the piles of mail and books and boxes. Malcolm returned with a wooden chair and, with a huff, angled it into the surrounding mess. As soon as he sat down, she could smell him. He had an odor like talc, fringed with cigarette smoke and the faint scent of pasta. She could hear his breathing, too, a wheeze from inside his shirt. Other than in class or on a crowded subway car, it had been a long time, nearly a year, since she had been in such close proximity to a man. The summer before, back at home, she'd met a guy named Andy who'd come up from Florida to work at the organic farm near her house. She was at the farmer's stand, which the farm set up at the edge of the road, and he'd carried the bags of sweet corn and tomatoes she brought out to her car and asked if she wanted to go swimming sometime at the quarries. Over the summer, they'd gone to the movies in Montpelier a few times, had dinner in town, or spent their Sundays poking around yard sales, all of which was new to her. Throughout high school, she'd never even had a date. She'd spent prom night watching movies with her parents. Andy, however, would not be the one to initiate her into the more graduated realms of physical love, a fact, in retrospect, that she found both disappointing and kind of a relief. She'd liked him. He was upbeat and friendly, if a bit odd-looking, stout, with a permanent pursed-lip expression which reminded her of the faces of her brother's old miniature army figurines. And, like those figurines, he was silent, stoic. In the car, rather than have a conversation, he preferred to play his favorite mixtapes on the stereo. When they went on a walk to the river or into town, he whistled to pass the time and barely responded to her attempts at making even casual banter. These situations didn't necessarily make her feel lonely. She knew what it was to spend time with someone and not speak. She and her brother could hike for hours up Mount Mansfield and barely say a thing. But the more time she spent with Andy, the greater her sense of irrelevance grew. And when they fooled around in his friend's borrowed truck or on the couch in the farmhouse he shared with the other farmhands, his mouth on hers, his hands groping, she couldn't get the thought out of her head. "You're a stranger to me." It always stopped her, made her pull away from him, just when things were progressing. Toward the end of the summer, he'd been at her house and noticed the certificate showing that she'd been a National Honor Society student throughout high school. Out of nowhere, he announced that he'd always hated school, and that he'd never done his homework because he thought it was a waste of time. She didn't know what to say to this. Considering how little he'd chosen to tell her about himself, she had no choice but to take it as an insult. This moment marked the end of their romance. Days later, when she stopped by the farm stand to say hello, he didn't even come out of the greenhouse. She waited around a bit, turning the produce in her hands, touching the leaves of the potted flowers until she felt truly pathetic, then threw a few plums in a paper bag and left her money in the wooden box with its handwritten sign that said, "Honor System." Malcolm flipped casually through a submission, took out the self-addressed stamped envelope, folded up the story, popped in a rejection slip, sealed the envelope, and tossed it in an empty box between them. He'd barely read a word. Within seconds, he was on to the next one, and then the next, and the next. Open, skim, fold, stuff, toss, again and again. At one point, he started humming and tapping his foot. Nan tried to ignore him and turned back to a group of four poems she just opened, submitted by what seemed to be an older man in Maine who'd mentioned in his cover letter that he'd published some of his poems in his local church newsletter. "My work is my life," he wrote in shaky scrawl. "Well, what's left of my life, anyway." The poems actually weren't bad. A short meditation on a saltwater marsh, an ode to an osprey, and two linked poems about an old house built on the tip of an island. They reminded her of home, or rather, the way she felt about her home. True, pure observations of a world that was clearly known and loved. It was the first submission that made her feel hopeful. She clipped the poems, the cover letter, and the self-addressed stamped envelope together and put them off to the side. She could sense Malcolm was watching her. "What are you doing?" he whispered. "What do you mean? Are you actually recommending those?" Tammy, typing away at lightning speed on the computer, stopped for a moment. "Guys," she said, raising her head but not turning around, "I realize you might need to talk a little bit, but as I asked you before, I'd like to maintain a library-type atmosphere in here. Is that clear?" "Yes," said Malcolm. "Sorry," said Nan. "Thank you," said Tammy, and resumed typing. Malcolm eyed the submission. "What?" Nan mouthed. He was looking at her with such incredulity, it was alarming. He pointed at the poems. "I put some of the poems aside that I think are promising," she whispered, "to come back to later." He looked at her skeptically. "Only if they're good," she said, "or at least interesting." "Are those at least good or interesting?" "At this point," she said quietly, "yes, they are." "Well, let's just see about that," he said, and snatched the submission up from the table. She watched his face reading them, the words and the poems reflected in the lenses of his glasses. After 2 minutes, he tossed the poems on the table. Crap. Not crap, she said. Yes, crap, he said, smiling. They're like little ditties or something. Little poems about nature, birds, water. That's it. There's nothing to them. That's not real poetry. You can't say that, she said, her voice rising. You didn't even read them all. Tammy stopped typing again. Nan and Malcolm froze. Library type atmosphere, please. I don't have to read them all, he whispered, leaning toward her. I got the gist, and they're all kind of crappy. The word crappy made her angry. He was criticizing the poems for not being poetic enough, but there he was, describing them with all the sophistication of a middle school brat. Well, she said, to me they're worth looking at again. Do what you want, he mumbled, but I hope you don't waste Professor Paulson's time on them. Why do you say that? He turned around to make sure Tammy was still working. Do you see this stuff? He pointed to the boxes of mail. Do you see how much backlog they have? That's what we're here to do, Nan, to clear it out, to make it go away. He picked up the submission and waved it around. You're not here to discover the next Robert Frost, and I'm not here to find the next Don freaking DeLillo. He kicked the bin full of rejected manuscripts. We're glorified envelope stuffers. Don't you get it? This is just grunt work. We're here to get this shit back to the poor, clueless people who sent it in, and in return we get our names at the bottom of the masthead, which we can put on our resumes. That's the deal. Got it? Then where did the pieces that get accepted come from? Somewhere else, he said. Not through us. She said nothing. She didn't even look at him. She couldn't look at the poems either, feeling guilty that they'd overheard his rant. Look, he said, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but I've been here a while. And the three or four things I've ever passed on to Paulson all got sent back, almost immediately. He barely even glanced at them. She looked down at the bin of rejected letters. She'd contributed maybe 10 to the pile. On one, from a teenage girl in Canada, she'd written, sorry. Not because the work was promising, but because the girl was in high school, and her poems were full of longing and loneliness and desperation. She did feel sorry for the girl, but on some level she admired her, too. Because would she, Nan, ever have the courage to submit her own work to a place like this, knowing full well it would most likely be turned down? Did these people who submitted their writing have any idea it would be rejected as quickly and thoughtlessly as one might dispose of a used tissue, and by someone who described their work as crappy? Are you a writer? Malcolm asked, looking at her as if asking if she were dying. God, no, she said. Not at all. Really? He said, surprised. Really? Then what are you even doing here? She looked at all the poems all around her, the doom verses penned by the wallflowers of the world, her people. Honestly, at this point, she said, I don't know. Well, that's kind of sad. Why? She asked loudly. Why is it sad? Tammy stopped typing, hopped up out of her seat, and marched over to their desk. Okay, kids, she said, that's all for today. I'm going to make up a schedule so you're both not here at the same time, because when you are, you clearly don't get anything done. She peered down into the bin, but didn't look disappointed. Plus, she said, I have to leave early to pick up my daughter, so you might as well go too. While Malcolm tried to convince Tammy to let him take the unread box of mail home, Nan quickly gathered her coat and bag and made for the door. Bye, said Nan, her hand on the doorknob. Wait up, hon, said Tammy. Where do you live? Just around the corner, she said. Up Riverside. You can't walk home alone, said Tammy. It's already dark out. Someone from the International House got attacked by Grant's tomb just last week. Didn't you see that in the school paper? Malcolm, she looked at him pointedly, will walk you home. No, it's fine, said Nan. I'm fine. I walk this way all the time. It's totally not necessary. Yes, it is, said Malcolm. She's right. It's probably not safe. And plus, he replaced the box of submissions on the tilting stack. I guess I should apologize to you. There's no need, she said. You don't have to. Yes, he does, Nan, said Tammy, turning to him. Walk her home and apologize. You were such a jerk to her. I heard everything you said. Why are you such a jerk? He looked down at his shoes, instantly ashamed. I don't know. The next day, she went to see her advisor. But by the time she got there, his office hours were over, and he was packing up his briefcase. He suggested they go get some coffee before he had to attend a lecture at the School of Journalism. "Tammy says you're doing a great job at the magazine," he said, as they sat in the small cafe in the Humanities Building. "Really? It's important work you're doing," he said, leaning back in his chair, holding his paper coffee cup delicately by the base as if it were made of crystal. "There are so few magazines out there that publish challenging, quality work. The creative and intellectual world seems to be tapering every year, and with it goes the essential forum for new literary voices." The tapering world of what? The forum for whom? What was he talking about? She was too distracted watching his coffee cup, which was precariously tipping on the verge of spilling on his expensive-looking shirt. Plus, this wasn't at all what she'd come to talk to him about. She'd come for answers, to find out if what Malcolm said was right. Was she just a glorified envelope stuffer? Did her work at the magazine have any real meaning besides what, in years to come, when the right technology was developed, could most likely be assigned to a machine? Malcolm had proposed this idea, being replaced by a robot, when he walked her home the night before. She'd pictured a vending machine-type contraption, in which you fed the submission in a slot, and seconds later the self-addressed stamped envelope appeared in a chute below with the machine's choice of rejection slips, indicated on a printed receipt, folded somewhere inside. She laughed at the absurdity of the idea, which pleased Malcolm, so he asked her out for a drink. Did she drink? No, not often, but yes, she said. Fine, okay, one drink. They went to a bar and a restaurant near her house. The place was crowded, so their stools were pushed close together, their knees occasionally colliding. His were bony and sharp, the caps distinctive against his brown corduroys. He did most of the talking, about the stress and terror of graduation, about moving back to the city having spent the summer upstate where his father was an antique dealer and his mother a lawyer, about his sister, whom he couldn't relate to at all, and how she'd recently had a baby, which made her seem even more distant. More strange, the miracle of life imbuing her with a power he'd never dreamed she was capable of. Since moving back, he'd been looking for a job at a newspaper or magazine. It didn't matter which, because it was just a temporary measure, since he was hard at work on a novel that, once finished, he was planning to send to a literary agent his mother knew. His scheme sounded highly conceived. He'd send it to the agent, and the agent would send it to the best editors at the best publishers, those who gave the biggest advances and had the good reputation for publicity, and they would all want it and bid for it, and it would go to the most deserving. He saw himself traveling around the country, around the world, with standing room only audiences, reading from his book, sharing with the unenlightened masses this product of his unique and compelling sensibility. Nan listened and nodded, and made small comments when they seemed called for. Although Malcolm apparently knew every aspect of the publishing business, much more than she had even thought about, a part of him still seemed confused and afraid, which, along with the glass of white wine she was drinking too quickly, made him somewhat more appealing. A few times she caught herself peering into the spaces where his shirt gapped between the buttons, or staring at his slender, veined hands which he clasped and wrung while he spoke. He no longer bore traces of the officious bully he'd been at work. He was chatty and animated and occasionally charming, the exact opposite of farmhand Andy's impenetrable humming or laconic clenched jaw profile, illuminated in the green dashboard lights of the farm's rusted-out pickup truck. After about an hour, she wondered if Malcolm would ask her anything about herself. In a way, she wanted him to, despite her fear of having to rise to his level of divulgence. But he never did. He continued to talk at length about himself and his work. His novel was a retelling of some Eastern European fable she didn't know, cast in the modern day, with the contemporary crisis of terrorism and drug trafficking and controversial scientific experiments replacing the antiquated moralistic issues the original text wrestled with, which he considered mundane. "These contemporary elements make it marketable," he said, "and relevant, newsworthy. Writing these days is about tie-ins, about dovetailing your product with pre-existing audiences and customers." She didn't know what this meant, and, based on his description, the book didn't seem like something she would choose to read or write. But it did sound interesting, or rather, his intensity for it was interesting, and again, attractive. After her glass of wine and his two beers, his phone rang, and without answering it, he told her that he had to be going. He walked her to her door at Riverside Drive and gave her an awkward kiss on the cheek. He said he looked forward to seeing her sometime soon, and maybe they could have dinner sometime. She said, sure. On the elevator ride up to her floor, she thought, that was kind of nice. And she believed it, despite the fact that he hadn't asked her anything and hadn't remembered to apologize. Can I ask you something? Nan said to her advisor. About the magazine? Bien sûr. In reading, she said slowly, in reading the submissions, how do you suggest we go about it? He tilted his head at her, puzzled and amused. She didn't want to give him the impression that, despite Tammy's praise, she didn't know what she was doing. But she also wanted some real answers. A lot of it is terrible, he said, laughing. Is that what you're getting at? It's just awful. And some of it, I know, can be pretty odd. He said odd in a way that meant raunchy. It seemed like an excuse to introduce that tone to the discussion. No, she said. What I mean is, don't you agree? He said. Nan, most of the stuff is horrendous. I know, she said. Or no, I guess I can see how you'd say that. It's just, it can feel so strange reading these things. There are so many people out there writing. Too many, he said. You've seen all the boxes. Yes, she said, sitting up in her chair. I guess it's just I read these pieces, and sure, maybe they're not great, or sometimes they're not even good, but I can't help picturing the person on the other end who's put everything they had into writing it. And so often it ends up being someone who's alone or old or sick. She stopped herself. She realized she sounded as pitiful as the people she was describing. But I definitely enjoy it, and I appreciate the opportunity. Well, now, he said, it doesn't really sound like you do. He was smiling, teasing her. She felt like the ground was slipping out from under her. I do, though, she said. I really do. I figured this would be a great fit because you're so bright, he said, and because of your own interest in writing. I read some of your pieces from your fiction workshop, and they really were quite strong, really quite good. You did? She said. How did you? Your teacher gave them to me, he said. I published one of her stories years ago in the magazine, and we've stayed in touch over the years. She's a real talented lady. He looked at her seriously. Much in the way you are, or will be. I'd like to see more of your work, if you haven't. She hadn't thought about her teacher in a long time, and the memory of her, and the story she'd hijacked, made her mouth seize up. You're miles ahead of Malcolm, that's for sure, he said with a snort. Have you read his stuff? I'm sorry? I really shouldn't share this with you, he said, leaning toward her with an air of conspiracy. But poor Malcolm. He gave me the first half of the novel he's working on, and, well, he's a very bright man, but he's not a writer. He doesn't possess what I consider to be a creative mind. He doesn't? Believe me, he said. He's down the rest of his coffee and glanced at his watch. It's pretty awful. He got up and put on his coat. But what are you going to say to him? She asked. Do you know what you're going to say? I haven't the slightest idea, he sighed. I don't want to shatter him, but I don't want him to believe that there's actual hope for that kind of mess. That kind of mess. The appraisal was just a few deviations from crappy. You've never read his work, he said, placing his tweed cap on his head. She shook her head. Has he read any of yours? She shook her head again. I'd advise against that kind of exchange, he said, smiling down at her, especially since Tammy seems to think he's got a sweet spot for you. No, your vehemence is encouraging, he said. But, as I said before, he's a nice kid, smart, hardworking, but he's not good enough for someone like you. When Nan got to work the following week, the intern's desk was empty except for a pile of miniature candy bars on the stack of rejection slips. Tammy had left the candy along with a note saying that she'd be out of the office for a few hours, something about a meeting with a new printer in Midtown. Hold down the fort, she'd written, accompanied by a smiley face. Nan searched the stacks of plastic postal boxes, arranged by date along the wall, to find the oldest one. A few months had passed since the submissions had arrived at the office, and it was crammed full. She glanced at the list of submitters that Tammy typed up and taped to the front of every box, and immediately recognized the name of the old man from Maine, whose poems she'd admired but had ultimately rejected after her conversation with Malcolm. She thought of her advisor's dismissal of his novel, and felt disappointed in herself that she'd let him sway her. The protocol for reading the submissions was to start at the front of the box and work your way back, in order of arrival, but because she was alone in the office, no one there to monitor her, she thumbed through all the envelopes, looking for the man's name written on the return address. The more she searched, the more nervous she grew, remembering the vague elements of his last cover letter. He was old. Was that right? Or sick? Or both? She couldn't quite remember anything particular about him other than some of the images he'd written about that had stayed with her. A great blue heron flying over the marsh, a tide pool at twilight, a lighthouse being struck by storm waves. Finally, she found it, a plain white envelope, which he'd addressed in his shaky handwriting to poetry editor. His cover letter stated that he'd meant to include a few additional poems in his last submission but had forgotten them. I submit these new poems for your consideration. Sorry to badger you. As always, I look forward to your response. Nan read the poems, two of which he'd submitted before, or perhaps they were revised. She couldn't tell for sure. The new poems were similar to the others, beautiful, simple, and again, they made her think of home, and, unexpectedly, of things about home she hadn't thought of in years. The time she found a family of raccoons in her father's workshop, the old woman from her town who'd won medals for her knitting, who gave away her projects to the poor and homeless at the holidays. And she thought of her brother. Of course she did. She thought of him every day of her life. But this was new. For the first time, he appeared in her mind alongside these other memories, the memories of things she upheld as beautiful, as humbling and real, evidence of her own existence, aspects of a world she felt she was always at risk of losing. She read the poems again and again, with an overwhelming feeling of gratitude for the old man, whom she'd never met and most likely never would. She took the cover letter over to Tammy's desk and called the number at the top of the page. "Hello?" said a woman's voice. "Hello," said Nan. "May I please speak to Mr. Lawrence Nickerson?" The woman on the other end paused for a moment. "Why?" she said. "What is this about?" What was it about? Thought Nan. She had no authority to accept his work or tell him anything other than she liked his poems. And would that matter, really, when in the end they would most likely be sent back to him? "Hello?" said the woman again. "Yes," said Nan. "I'm calling from the offices of Verbiage Magazine in New York. He submitted some poems some time ago, and I'd like to speak to him about them." "Really?" she said. "Are you going to publish them?" "That's what I'd like to speak to him about." She started to sweat, her teeth clenching tightly. "He published some of his poems in our church newsletter," said the woman hopefully. "Everyone loved them. And he was planning for a book of his own, too." "He was planning," she heard. "Is he there?" asked Nan. "May I speak with him, please?" The woman was silent. "He's not," she said finally. "Actually, he's passed. About a month ago. He was real sick. I'm his daughter. You're speaking to his daughter." "Oh," said Nan. "I'm very sorry to hear that." She heard in her own voice that same thoughtful, useless sentiment she'd heard when her own brother had died. "Thank you," said the woman. "That's very kind of you, but do you think you might take his poems to publish in your magazine? It would have really made him so happy." "We're thinking seriously about them," said Nan. She didn't realize how easily lying would come to her. She thought of the way her advisor spoke, his clean, unwavering confidence, and imagined his voice coming through her. "We were going to see if he would be willing to make a few minor revisions to the work before we made our final decision," she said. "But considering the circumstances..." "The circumstances?" said the woman. "If you liked them enough, and you thought they were up to your standards, why don't you just publish them? It's not like he can make any changes to them now." It was his life's goal to be published, and published in a real magazine like yours. Why not just make it come true, even though he's not here anymore to see it for himself? I would, said Nan. I would like to, but... She got up from the chair. Someone was coming into the building. She could hear Tammy's voice yelling into her cell phone out in the hallway. Let me get back to you, said Nan. Listen, said the woman. It would mean so much to him, to us, his entire family. Nan hung up the phone just as Tammy stumbled into the office, shaking her umbrella. She looked quizzically at Nan, standing over her desk, her hand still on the phone. Hi, said Nan. Sorry, I was just checking my messages. Oh, that's fine, said Tammy, smiling. Anything from Malcolm? No, she said, her face suddenly burning. Before she could walk back to her desk, the phone began to ring. Check the number, said Tammy, hanging up her coat. Anyone we know? Nan read out the number off the caller ID display. She recognized it immediately. I don't know anyone in the area code. 207? Where is that? Said Tammy. I have no idea. Let the machine get it, said Tammy. It's probably another one of the crazies. She pulled out a handful of Hershey's Kisses from her sweater pocket and placed them in Nan's hand. Thanks for keeping an eye on everything for me. You're a good egg. Nan finished her work, went home, sat at her desk, took out her journal from the bottom drawer and opened to a new page. She had no structure, no plan, no concrete story in mind, only an idea that had been swirling around her brain since reading the man's poems and speaking to his daughter. The idea was about a boy who lived in Vermont with his parents and younger sister. He was quiet and kind, quick, but never a good student. He preferred to be outside in nature, and after high school, as a compromise to his parents, he enrolled in agricultural college. Eventually, however, he dropped out and got a job at the town co-op. Every day his sister would come in and visit him on her way back from high school, and when he was done with his shift, they would walk home together, through the fields behind the farms, into the wide meadow at the back of their house. They'd walk in silence mostly, pointing out different things along the way, the broad ferns wagging in the breeze on the forest floor, the brown trout jumping from mayflies in the river, a group of deer eating low-bushed blueberries. She knew her teacher would have told her that it was not a story. It was a sketch, a scene at best, and that the members of her class would have complained that it was boring. They'd insist she had more drama, maybe some drug use, perhaps a scene of sexual transgression to spice things up. But she didn't care. She kept writing, tuning out those voices just as she had learned to tune out the voices of the hundreds of people she had rejected since starting up the magazine, sending their poems back to them in the envelopes they had addressed to themselves. Every day when she came home from class or work, she would write something new about the boy's life, something she'd remembered or something she had tried to forget. So much was coming back to her. She called him the boy or the brother or the son. The girl was just the girl. It was also freeing, this new effigy of her life, like she was telling a secret, or perpetually finding something she thought she'd misplaced. She wrote late into the night and fell asleep thinking of what could happen next, elated by the world she had managed to recapture, but terrified of how she knew it would have to end. Malcolm called her at the office and asked her if she wanted to have dinner with him that evening. Tammy listened in on their conversation, smiling and shaking her head. He's come a long way, she said once Nan hung up the phone. Calling a girl to go out? Wow, you have no idea. Nan said nothing. You're shy, she said. I get that, but he's shy. And now he calls you to have dinner? It makes me want to weep. Honestly, it's just amazing. She stood up and took Nan by the elbows. You're going to go, right? Yes, said Nan. I just said I would. I know, said Tammy. I'm just making sure you're going to show up. If you didn't, it would break his heart. I doubt that. Don't doubt it, said Tammy. I've known him for a long time. This is a big deal for him. Take my word for it. He likes you. He always acts like a jerk to me. Well, you know how boys can be. I know, said Nan, lying without even thinking about it. She met him at an Italian restaurant on Amsterdam Avenue, down the street from the housing projects on 125th. They sat at a shadowy table near the window, with a radiator pipe that blasted dry heat into the back of Nan's chair so she couldn't sit back all the way. Malcolm, dressed in an unraveling zip-up Scandinavian sweater, looked sullen, and she worried he'd regretted asking her out. "Are you okay?" she said. "Yeah," he said, "I'm just annoyed. I sent my stories out to all these places, all these different magazines, and they basically all got rejected. I got the last one today." Nan pictured someone not unlike Malcolm at all these other magazines, glancing over his stories and cavalierly dropping a rejection slip in the envelope he'd enclosed. "Were there any notes of any kind?" she said, trying to sound hopeful. "Anything more personal?" He shook his head miserably. "I'm sorry," she said. "It's so disappointing, but what?" "I was just going to say," she said gently. His eyes were boring into her from across the table. "Isn't that just the way it is? I mean, what one has to expect from a writer's life? You know, rejection and disappointment and setbacks until finally someone, the right person, gets what you're doing?" She felt like she was talking to herself, giving him the same pep talk she used to give herself every day after her fiction writing class. "Most of the writers we know now, famous ones like T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, that's sort of what their stories were like. They had to wait years until they were discovered and appreciated." "I'm aware of all that," he said, pushing his water glass around. "It's just so frustrating because there's so much crap out there. I just know that my work is 1,000 times better." Nan thought about this. It was true. Most of the work they read for the magazine was not good. But how could he believe his work was better than everything being written out there in the world? And why did he always have to use the word crap to describe things? "You just have to keep trying," she said. "Keep working." He scoffed at this, his typical little snort, which she had come to understand was his way of showing disagreement or demonstrating how misguided someone was. He did it to Tammy all the time. Nan thought about how her advisor had described his novel, a mess, and decided to let it go. "I know you're trying to be helpful," he said, with a trace of accusation in his voice, "but you don't write, so you don't know. You don't know what you're talking about." He sat back in his seat and folded his arms. "You're not a writer, so you're talking about stuff you don't know about." He might as well have slapped her. At least then, she thought, she would have felt the pain only in her face. Whereas now, it was everywhere, a searing, burning current thrumming through her body. He wouldn't look at her. He busied himself scanning the laminated menu. She knew that if he suggested they share an appetizer, she would get up and walk out. "I know I'm not a writer," she said slowly, "but that doesn't mean I can't empathize with what you're going through. I do, after all, read submissions all day long, so I'm familiar with the process, at least." He rolled his eyes. "That's so not the same thing." The radiator pipe behind her made her scalp feel singed. "Well," she said, "I would like to think that it wouldn't come as a complete surprise to you when you get rejected, considering how many manuscripts you reject without even reading them." "What?" He clenched the menu. "I'm just saying," she said quickly, "think of all the people who feel like you do now, and think of how we're responsible for making them feel that way. And who are we to inflict that? Honestly, who are we to reject their work and destroy their hopes and dreams?" "Oh, God, spare me," he said. "Destroy their hopes and dreams? I really am surprised that Professor Paulson even gave you this job. You're obviously too sensitive for it." What had been pain running through her body was now rage, whipping at her ribs, her wrists, her temples like a kite tail. "Well, I'm surprised you gave him your novel to read," she said, unable to stop herself. "Excuse me?" he said. "Did he tell you that? Because now I know I didn't. I didn't tell anyone." A busboy arrived with a small bowl of olives, lolling in oil, and a basket of bread. "Has he told you something about it?" he said, leaning into the table toward her. "Because he hasn't told me anything, and it's been more than a month. I've been waiting to see what he says before I send it to this agent. What did he tell you?" He had changed so quickly before her eyes, from strident to pathetic, all in an instant. Nan wondered if this was what Tammy meant by how boys can be. His mood now seemed as precarious as the weather on the other side of the window. Rain into sleet into snow, slush splashing up from the tires of the passing cars outside on the street. "He didn't tell me what he thought," she said carefully, "only that you'd given it to him to read." He looked at her skeptically. "I don't believe you, Nan," he said. "I can tell you're lying. You're a bad liar. You're too honest a person." He made it sound like a compliment and a flaw. "And what?" she said. "You're a good liar? A real writer has to be. So, in order to be a real writer," she said, "you have to be a liar." "No," he said. "In order to be a real writer, you have to know how to lie well, to make stuff up that's believable. That's the difference. Get it?" Nan thought about it, and all at once she did get it. She understood. And suddenly she knew what would happen to the boy in her story. He would live. He didn't have to die, as her brother had, and tear her fictionalized family apart, leaving it emptied, bereft, lost as the real one had been and still was. She could lie about it, a permissible, understandable lie, a lie in the name of catharsis, of escape, of peace. "Thank you," she said quietly, staring out at the snow. "That's actually really helpful." He looked at her, confused and annoyed. "Anytime," he said. "Now, can you be helpful to me and tell me what Paulson said about my novel?" "Yes," she thought, barely hearing him, putting an olive in her mouth, rolling it along the inside of her teeth, tearing the pit from the salty flesh with her tongue. The boy wouldn't have to die. But maybe someone else would. Maybe someone else should. Perhaps a neighbor, an old neighbor, whom she hadn't even invented yet. An old poet, well-published, renowned, who dies in his sleep in a farmhouse after a long, fulfilling life, with his daughter at his side. Or maybe the laconic farmhand would die. She'd only written about him briefly, but his character could be expanded. Maybe she'd kill him off after he'd insulted the girl, who'd been agonizing over whether to give him her virginity. Maybe he drowns in the quarry, she thought, or in Lake Champlain when they're canoeing. That could be dramatic and real. After all, she knew what a drowned body looked like. And if pressed, she could describe that hollowed-out look the dead have. She knew she could do it justice, reveal its awful, hidden dignity. "Yes," she thought. "Yes." "Hello," said Malcolm, staring at her. "Nan, are you there?" "Paulson said that he really liked it," she said. "He did? Are you serious? Is that what he really said?" She nodded, half nodded. He sat back in his chair. He looked relieved. She felt a sudden sense of accomplishment, of understanding, as if an aspect of the world had been revealed to her with the sole purpose of making her stronger. She removed the olive pit from her mouth and placed it on the clean white plate between them.